for that to start.
I might say this, I'm getting more coming later, but this is good stuff.
And what is a good time to start?
Well, this is great. Yes.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we might start. So may I welcome you to the latest of the occasional lectures hosted by the Parliamentary Library, and welcome in particular Professor A.J. Brown. Nobody knows what A.J. Brown's Christian names are because he is universally called A.J. So to Professor A.J. Brown from Griffith University. A.J. is the John F. Carney Professor of Public Law at Griffith University Law School. Prior to joining Griffith University, he was a senior investigation officer with the Office of the Commonwealth Ombudsman. He served in a variety of advisory roles to ministers. He has, among other things, been director of Integrity and Corruption Research at the Key Centre for Ethics, Law, Justice and Governance at Griffith University. He holds bachelor's degrees in politics and law from the University of New South Wales and a PhD from Griffith University. The topic of today's address falls squarely within AJ's area of academic specialisation in accountability, public law and public policy. He was the lead author of the Australian Research Council funded National Integrity System Assessment of Australia, a collaborative project with Transparency International, of which he is now a member of the Board of Directors. He's also, among many scholarly publications, the author of Whistleblowing in the Australian Public Sector, and is also welcome in this building in an entirely different capacity. He is the son of the late Wallace Brown, one of the most illustrious Canberra press gallery journalists who has ever graced this building, or perhaps it would be right to say mainly the previous old Parliament House. And those of us who grew up in Brisbane, in my generation at least, learnt our politics from reading Wallace Brown. So AJ, in that capacity as well, it's delightful to have you here. Thank you for making the time to be with us, and we look forward to what you have to say.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much, George. Thank you for the personal note. If my father was here, he would say, well, now you'll have to learn something about politics from me. but that's only if he was here. So thank you very much, George. It's very nice to be introduced by a senator from our home state as well. Thank you very much to the library for the invitation to come back and speak to you today about integrity and accountability. I had the pleasure of talking to a similar seminar about 4 years ago on whistleblowing legislation in particular, at a time when I think, with no offence to the then government, it might have been safe to say that it was a bit of a case of dancing in the rain. So I thought that it was a particularly irrefusable offer to come back and speak about integrity and accountability issues a little bit more broadly today, because of the fact that really there's been no time in my memory, and I think really for many decades, that there's been such a rich marketplace of ideas, of political ideas on issues of integrity, accountability and transparency, as there is now. We're living and you're working in an environment where really it is hard to think of a time quite like this, where no political party or interest or independent has a monopoly on integrity and accountability issues, where the nature of the parliament, but also the history of how we've got to where we are on a number of key integrity and accountability issues, really means that there is this magnificent competition going on between all parties on a number of the key issues, which for at least a few decades there has effectively been no real competition on between political parties or political interests. And we're reminded of that just this week by the most significant reform so far in the life of this Parliament, which is the passage through the House on Monday of the Shield Laws for Journalists legislation, now headed for the Senate. And that in itself sums up the interesting situation that we're in. That although the Rudd government came to power with all sorts of commitments to do things for transparency and accountability, on that particular issue, the government did not do well. It's appropriate that George is sitting here because, in fact, it was the opposition that actually proposed that it could be stronger or more effective at the time. And now it's finally under the auspices of the current arrangements with the Home Parliament that the actual provisions are sailing through, which are largely consistent with Senator Brandis's position. So presumably that will be supported by all parties, and that issue will be resolved in the public interest quite satisfactorily. And that's just one issue. My purpose today was to canvass a number of issues, a few issues, not too many because there are very many of them, but that we do have a lot of work over the next 12 months and I suspect the whole next term of government to actually see many of the key issues about which people are competing at the moment, healthily competing for ideas and solutions, to see those come through to some very important to fruition for some very important reforms for public integrity in Australia, particularly at the Commonwealth level. As George mentioned, I was the lead author of a large national project involving a lot of researchers across a range of disciplines looking at integrity systems a few years ago. The reason for referring to that is that time has moved on quite a bit since then, but the nature of the project involved mapping a range of issues to do with integrity and accountability, many of which are now in the mix of the debates that are happening now. I suppose it's timely to refer back to that, not so much because of the precise content of what we recommended out of that project, as much as the fact that the whole project was based on the premise that at certain times you need to take a systemic or holistic approach to some of the reforms that otherwise over time might have been regarded as unrelated or one-off reforms in this sort of field, because of the fact that the public policy focus and political focus only very rarely turns in a big way to integrity and accountability issues as a whole. Generally speaking, our policy systems aren't well tuned to thinking about integrity systems and accountability systems as a whole. We tend to think of them in little chunks, especially lawyers over here and political scientists over there and political practitioners in another corner altogether. But one of the premises for the National Integrity System Assessment Project was the concept of the fact that there is a whole system, simplistically represented by, in this slide, as a Greek temple, which is the way that Transparency International has presented it in its international resources. Recently, that idea of taking a more systemic approach has been catching on in a number of jurisdictions in Australia. It's been catching on to a greater extent at a Commonwealth level as well over the last few years in various ways. Senator John Faulkner in particular pursued and articulated reforms in a connected way, more connected than previously. But at a state level, the idea of trying to take a systemic approach to integrity and accountability reforms has latched on in a very big way. Both the Queensland and the Victorian governments over the last 12 to 18 months have taken that approach to doing a systematic run through of public integrity and accountability systems from the point of view of identifying gaps, making sure that things are lining up, keeping things up to date. Not driven entirely by particular scandals, although there are always particular scandals that do help ensure that there is the momentum for reform. This slide, which I appreciate you can't read, is a picture out of the May report of Victoria's review of integrity and accountability systems. And it just shows the institutional landscape, the basic institutional landscape of what's there and what is proposed in an upgrade and an update of that particular system. And I'll come back to that, notwithstanding the fact that that it's difficult to read, but it's just one example of that more systemic approach. part of what I'll say is really aimed at provoking the question, I guess, of exactly what processes are going to work for the Parliament now at a Commonwealth level, with the number of commitments that have been made to do a number of things and the number of processes that are already running. What process is the Parliament going to adopt for bringing these, or keeping these things coordinated, bringing them together in a holistic way? And I don't have a precise answer for that. It's just more important that the question be acknowledged as being one that should be given a fair bit of priority at the moment. I'm sure it already is, but in that case, I'm here to reinforce it. Another thing, this is another picture you can't read out of the same report from Victoria. One of the other useful figures in that particular report was the way in which the review team there articulated the spectrum between integrity on the left through maladministration, through misconduct, to corruption on the right. I'm not sure why the arrow is going that way. I think we want the arrow going the other way myself. But the important thing about that is that it was quite an intelligent way of saying corruption doesn't sit over there with an anti-corruption commission, and maladministration is over here and something that's unrelated, and the Ombudsman deals with that, and these things aren't connected. But basically, when we're talking about our systems of integrity and accountability, we're dealing with behaviours that go right across that spectrum, in every shade of that spectrum, and that there are overlaps between the there should be overlaps between the jurisdictions of bodies. There are overlaps in the definition of what type of conduct is either being promoted or trying to be compensated for or prevented or detected or remedied or whatever. And that actually changes our view of how we see the institutional landscape and how we see the legislation that covers integrity and accountability. Whistleblowing legislation is about flushing out issues and ensuring that systems function with integrity by ensuring that other types of behaviour are disclosed. The detection of and the rectification of maladministration is often the way in which more serious problems get identified. Some problems are systemic, some problems are individual, and it's important that even if there are specialisations within the system in terms of how issues are dealt with, that the system does actually function as a whole. There was a wide range of recommendations from that integrity system assessment report. I'm not going to go through any of them. Some of them, I just thought I'd put them up in order to highlight some of those which have been dealt with at a Commonwealth level or are being discussed at a Commonwealth level, which I'm not going to talk about. Freedom of information was one area where the Commonwealth system has now been radically reformed over the last couple of years, and that's in green there. And the other one in green there is the whole issue of effective disclosure of interests and influences, the whole debate about electoral funding disclosure and other types of similar types of disclosure is an important part of this landscape, which is under active debate again now and will have to be until it's resolved more satisfactorily. That's another issue that I'm not going to touch on now, but it's part of the whole landscape. The issues that I thought I would touch on with a degree of detail are actually the three in red, and which are our first recommendation way back then related to a Commonwealth Integrity Anti-Corruption Commission. Number six there was the question of how to enforce parliamentary and ministerial standards. And then the other one was whistleblower protection and management. And so what I'll do is I'll work back through those in the order of the ones that are the issues that are already furthest advanced, if you like, in terms of existing Commonwealth processes to have some action on. And my aim, apart from that larger question of what's the process for progressing these in a coordinated, systematic way that leads to an overall sort of major enhancement in the integrity and accountability system, my main other aim is simply to sort of provide some gratuitous advice to the Parliament, which I'm always happy to do, about some of the key issues that we need to keep our eye on for the resolution of those particular issues which are highlighted in red there. So I'll start with whistleblowing, which, as many of you know, has been a research specialisation of mine for the last few years in particular. And I won't wax too lyrical about whistleblowing and what it is and why it's significant. In Queensland, we're constantly reminded of the role of whistleblowing, the nature of whistleblowing, and the problems associated with encouraging it and managing it and protecting the people who do it, and making sure that whistleblowing contributes to the overall health of the public sector, by the infamous Giant Patel case, the Bundaberg Hospital case, and the case of the principal nurse, Tony Hoffman, who provoked the action eventually that needed to be taken for that to be dealt with. But there are many, many other examples, and not all of them fit neatly within particular boxes. If you saw me talking to Andrew Wilkie as who came in here, there was an example of a person who blew the whose tactical decision, I can say tactical because he's a former military officer, his tactical decision was to blow the whistle publicly in the first instance. That's not what most public servants do or want to do. And the vast bulk of whistleblowing that we need to encourage and need to manage more effectively is the case of people like Tony Hoffman, who try within the system in reasonable, normal ways to get something done about something which is going horrendously wrong, have trouble doing so, and it all goes wrong from there. And in this case, eventually, things went right, but it exposed enormous problems with the system, with how agencies handle whistleblowers, their responsiveness to it. And it's those more difficult organisational issues, human resource management issues, which are really the big difficulty of how to get organisations to recognise and respond to disclosures within their own ranks, and how to have a system which makes them do that is really 90% of the issue. Plenty of our research is available, as some of you will be aware, and you'll be able to get these slides afterwards if you want to access any of it, but we released the results of what is in fact the world's largest empirical research project into public sector whistleblowing 2 years ago here in Parliament House. So that's all available, and that's all in the background. Part of what's in what we published at the same time as that research was some of our assessment as to what all the research into whistleblowing means for whistleblowing legislation, which is now part of the agenda, has been part of the agenda for quite some time. So, and some of you will be aware of that, but the analysis that we came up with wasn't just mine. I was privileged to be joined by John McMillan and others in framing what we think is the basis of what any parliament needs to do. How it does it then becomes a bit more difficult. And there's really three issues to watch out for in what happens next. This issue is I'll just go on to this slide. The question of whistleblowing legislation, public interest disclosure legislation, is obviously very live for the Commonwealth right now, because it's been an issue which has been kicking around for over 15 years as to what the Commonwealth wanted to do in this space in terms of statutory encouragement and protection for public servants to and potentially public contractors, there's an issue, to come forward with information about perceived wrongdoing and ensure that it's properly managed and that they're properly managed. And where we're at now is the result of a certain history. The ALP came to office in 2007 with some very firm election commitments to move on best practice whistleblowing legislation. The good news was that then translated into a very comprehensive inquiry by the House of Reps Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee, chaired by Mark Dreyfus, and some people here, not looking anywhere in particular, had very important roles in that. The good news was that there were two very good things about that report. One was that it was very comprehensive and looked very much at the philosophy and the underlying principles of what needs to be addressed. So there's some great content in that report as well as its recommendations, and the fact that it was bipartisan. The Deputy Chair, Peter Slipper, made a point of coming along to the release of the report to emphasise that this was an issue on which there need be no political division. It was just time to move on with it. So that was a major step. In March last year, we saw the release of the Rudd government's response to that report, which in fact not only picked up almost all the recommendations, but surpassed them in some respects. So from that point, we've been tracking quite well in terms of a comprehensive, what would be globally the most comprehensive and effective legislative scheme you could put in place. So all those things were already travelling, and those processes have been going on, and the development of a bill is well advanced, as I understand it, before the election. And obviously with the election, written into this government's agreement with all the independents and the Greens is a commitment to not only introduce but seek to have this legislation passed by the Parliament by the 30th of June next year. So now is the time to get this particular package of the system right. It's a particularly important part of any integrity and accountability system because it cuts right across what everybody does. It cuts across the day-to-day life of public servants, it cuts across all agencies, it cuts across the business of everybody who's got a specialist interest in accountability and integrity, all the integrity agencies from the ANAO to the Ombudsman to ACLI to whoever might be created. And it's something in which the Parliament has a direct interest because parliamentarians, as well as having responsibility for the whole system, obviously field public interest disclosure type material as well. So it's one of those things which is an integration point for everything in the system. If you get this right, you get a lot of things right. If you get it wrong, then it's a sign that a lot of other things are probably still wrong as well. The important thing to note as this Commonwealth process has been going on is that every other Australian jurisdiction has been moving in this space. Since 4 years ago, when I gave a rundown on the state of this legislation nationally here, there's nothing is the same, almost nothing is the same, and anything that is the same is currently under review. The biggest single developments in the last couple of months is that Queensland has replaced its 1994 Whistleblower Protection Act with its 2010 Public Interest Disclosure Act, and that's happened. And it's a substantially different act in a significant number of respects. New South Wales has introduced its reform bill, which is also a significant advance in a significant number of respects. So everything is effectively sort of in the mix. Victoria is reviewing its legislation in the wake of this particular review of the whole system, and so it goes on. So the game has in fact changed even since the government's response at the beginning of last year, beginning of this year, the game has changed in terms of what legislative standards exist around other parts of the country. So again, this is a very rich marketplace of ideas in which we're currently working. In terms of the three major issues, just to go back to that slide, I'll just talk a little bit about some of the three most difficult things to get right, I guess, in this legislation based on experience so far. One is how public whistleblowing is dealt with. The second is what sort of systems are needed to encourage agencies to get it right, what sort of central oversight and coordination from a central integrity agency. And then the third, which is really probably now turning out to be the most vexed issue, is how best to compensate whistleblowers who do go through a hard time, which could mean anything from active and catastrophic reprisals through to just stress and hassle that isn't managed as well as it should be, and the impacts that has on careers, how to effectively ensure that whistleblowers are compensated for their experience. And that's probably turning into the most difficult issue, even though you would have thought it was the most obvious issue. So very quickly, just so I make sure I do spend a bit of time on the other issues as well, the Commonwealth Government's position as of March this year was, at that point, probably the most well thought out position in terms of when is it that a public servant should be able to go to the media and retain legal protection and rights to compensation, etc., for having gone outside the system. And it was a very sophisticated model of, at that point, the world's most sophisticated model of how you would legislate to provide for that. So that's sort of the current starting point for, can Commonwealth legislation deliver what's been signed onto there, or what's been articulated there by what was then the Rudd government? And I won't go through it in detail, but it gives you quite a comprehensive scheme of, these are the circumstances in which we basically acknowledge that somebody who goes public is justified and should retain their protection and legal support. But that's also actually now been changed a bit by what's happened in Queensland. In the Queensland Act, something much simpler has happened. There's no recognition of any ability to go direct to the media in the first instance, unlike the Commonwealth proposal. But it's all about whistleblowing as a last resort, which is actually pretty okay, because 92 to 97% of whistleblowers seek to go through somewhere in the system as a first resort. But what the Queensland proposal does is basically simply say that once you've gone to anybody, then if they don't deal with it, if they don't investigate it, or the outcome, there's no outcome to their investigation, then provided that you retain at least an honest belief on reasonable grounds that there is misconduct here as a result of that, then you can go to the media and still be protected, which is actually setting a very new threshold for public servants to be able to go to the media. I think that this is a challenge for the public sector to get its head around, something this simple, but the value in it is that it is going to be highly effective in saying to public sector agencies, be ready for this, deal with this, get it right, do it right the first instance, don't mess it up, and look after your people, and this won't happen to you. It won't be on the front page of the paper. And that is one of the few crucial drivers that are actually needed for any kind of whistleblower protection to be effective. It's what will lock agency organisational management into actually putting the effort into getting it right within the system. That's the crucial issue. So that's the first of the important issues there for the Commonwealth. I won't go through the other two issues other than to note that they're very, very important. And if they're ones to watch out for, how they'll be dealt with in the legislation are very important issues to watch out for. What I wanted to spend a little bit of time on as well as whistleblowing was the question of the institutional landscape within which whistleblowing protection or any other integrity investigation processes and accountability processes fit. And the reason for doing that is because that also is a particularly live and vital issue right now, given the current political landscape at a Commonwealth level, for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that, again, the agreements between the ALP and the Greens and all of the independents on which government now rests make some specific provision for institutional development in this area, but so does also the Agreement for a Better Parliamentary Reform document, which the Coalition is also party to, which forms the attachment to the Windsor-Oakeshott ALP agreement. Assuming that all of these agreements are intended to be honoured, which of course they are, I wouldn't ever assume anything other than that, then the basis is there for some very significant developments in a number of the areas to do with the broader institutional landscape. The explicit commitment that is in the most explicit commitment that's in the agreements, I actually put up all of clause 4.3 because I thought it would be remiss while speaking at a parliamentary library event not to mention the fact that there is a commitment to a new parliamentary budget office within the parliamentary library itself, and that there'll be a process needed, which is flagged in the agreements, a special committee in parliament to work out what that will be. So that's one thing that is in there about which I'm not proposing to say anything else. But in the same clause is the commitment to establish within 12 months a Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner role with a very significant portfolio of responsibilities. This is a major historical development. How it's done is crucial. It'll be something new and different. It won't have been done before, certainly in Australia, in quite this way. The Commonwealth is not the only jurisdiction to be moving on it, and I'll come back to that in a minute, because Victoria is also moving on the same model right now, as literally as we speak. So I'll come back to the Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner in a second. But one of the reasons for also throwing the canvas a little bit wider and talking about integrity commissions more generally is because this is also currently part of the landscape. As well as that specific commitment to a Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner, we have a number of things happening at a Commonwealth level. One is the Australian Commission for Law Enforcement Integrity, a recently established institution, which has been subject to debate even before it began as to what role it was going to fulfil in the Commonwealth integrity system, where it was going to fit, what its jurisdiction should be, why just law enforcement, why not more than that. On the other hand, there are counter arguments. But these questions have been live right from the beginning. For the last little while, over 12 months now, I think, the Joint Parliamentary Committee on the ACLEI has been conducting the first three-yearly review under the legislation of at least some of those questions, what this legislation is about and where it should be heading. And its chair is Melissa Park, who I'm delighted to see has actually joined us. And the result of its interim report before the election saw the first significant step towards the development of ACLEI, which was the addition of Customs and Border Protection to its jurisdiction, in addition to simply the Australian Federal Police and the Australian Crime Commission. And that in itself is a very significant development. What it reminds us of is that you can't throw neat boundaries around different agencies if you want to say, well, these are the ones that really need integrity and corruption oversight, and others don't need as much or need different or something. We've already got movement, even based on the initial model. And that'll be a very significant development. And that three-yearly review is ongoing, I believe, and I believe the committee's reconstituted, and unless anything has gone strange, then I believe Ms Park is the chair of that committee. She nods, so I'm reassured of that. So that process is now on foot, underway, under review, what should happen with ACLEI and its jurisdiction. But as well as that, we have the National Integrity Commissioner Bill reintroduced by Senator Bob Brown as a private member's bill, which also brings to a head a number of the key questions that have been that sit in the background, both to the formation of a Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner and to the question of ACLEI's jurisdiction. So you can see where I'm going here with saying there are all sorts of interrelated issues to how we deal with integrity and corruption at a Commonwealth level, which we've now got to deal with one way or another with all of these things happening at once. The particular proposal that's in the Greens National Integrity Commissioner Bill would include ACLEI in one integrity framework, one integrity overarching integrity commission, which has got a powerful logic to it. That particular bill proposes an independent parliamentary advisor as a statutory officer to boost integrity at a parliamentary level. But really that concept and that particular role has already been overtaken by the commitment to a Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner. So we've already got some shift there. And in addition to that, what the Greens proposal would do is basically throw a National Integrity Commission over the entire Commonwealth public sector. But it would also include judges and parliamentarians all in the one bag. So it's a... to that extent, it's a relatively simple proposal, but the question is whether that's the model that is the right model for solving all these complex interrelated questions. So the key issues that I wanted to flag in terms of these institutional developments, and there's some detail here which I'll skip over, which will be available to people who would like to know about it, are relatively simple. When it comes to the Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner, we've really got to decide, well, we've got to recognise that this is still a new idea for Australia, that we're in new ground, this is not off-the-shelf stuff, it's got to be designed well. Only Queensland has had an Integrity Commissioner up until now, and that's purely an advisory role, a capacity-building role, helping politicians and senior statutory office holders get their ethical and integrity decisions right, but not an investigative role. That's changed slightly in the last 12 months or so, but effectively that was the model on which it was established. What's proposed for the Commonwealth now is a new mix of both advisory and integrity building and supportive functions, and an ability to field complaints, investigate them, and actually make recommendations to the Privileges Committee on whether individual members or their staff whether their conduct is in line with an applicable code of conduct or not. Much more sort of serious and potentially contentious stuff. Victoria is also moving down that same track. It's a bit similar to the British model, but otherwise for us it's fairly new territory to have anything like this. It's important that it be done. It moves on what my colleague John Ewer from the ANU said a few years ago in his book Terms of Trust, was the state of puzzling self-regulation that still surrounded most politicians everywhere, and Commonwealth politicians in particular, compared to the types of integrity systems that we apply to the rest of the public sector. But how we do it is still a bit contentious. It's a little bit contentious in Victoria. Personally, I don't think it should be, but then I was a consultant to the review that recommended it, so maybe I'm biased. But in Victoria, they're proposing this blue box over here is actually the Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner. The debate is really about whether, like in Queensland or Western Australia, politicians should just be covered by the standing overall anti-corruption commission that sits down here in the new Victorian model. Personally, I think that moving down the path that the Commonwealth has flagged and Victoria has flagged is a sensible development on the more simplistic model of just throwing politicians and throwing judges in with the rest of the public servants for a variety of reasons, which including practical reasons as well as constitutional reasons or reasons of principle. But we can talk more about that if people want to. But irrespective of that, there is a question of the relationship between the new Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner and other integrity bodies. The Victorian recommendation is that the Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner will in effect act as a sort of a gateway and a clearinghouse, which means that it will, obviously the expectation obviously is that it will refer things that require serious investigation. That it will get the Anti-Corruption Commission or the relevant people or the police involved in that. That, to my mind, is the logical way to go about it. Rather than burdening an Anti-Corruption Commission with a whole lot of politics, you can quarantine the politics to the Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner. That would be the theory. We could talk more about that. In terms of larger question of a National Integrity Commission, it seems pretty clear from what the ACLEI Joint Committee is dealing with and the Greens proposal and the formation of a Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner and logic and almost every piece of research that's been conducted now, that this is something that the Commonwealth needs to grapple with and resolve. That law enforcement agencies are quite happy to admit, if you ask them, that they don't see any reason why they're the only ones who are subject to a stronger anti-corruption regime, and that they see problems in that because it just encourages those who want to corrupt the public sector to find their entry points in other places. So this is an issue on which movement is sort of logical and becoming somewhat inevitable, but there's a whole lot of institutional design questions that flow from that. What do we do with ACLI in this landscape if we're going to move down, if we're going to create some kind of other National Integrity Commission? The proactive education capacity building roles that should go with either ACLI or any Integrity Commission, which currently aren't properly recognised at a Commonwealth level, where they're put into the system, or whether these are roles that should just remain with existing agencies like the Australian Public Service Commission, remembering, of course, that it only covers half of all Commonwealth agencies and employees, etc. There are operational coordination issues between whatever agencies are created, and there are resourcing issues. And those issues, they sound like, you know, standard issues. Well, you know, we create a new agency, of course they have to be dealt with. But they're particularly complex here. And the other slides that I've got here, which I'll just skip over, from some of our previous research that emphasises this. I'll just deal a little bit with one issue on the resourcing front, just to show what interesting decisions the Commonwealth, the Parliament, and the government and the independents have to make about what they want, what you want, what we all want out of this particular landscape. When it comes to the resourcing that different jurisdictions are putting into these types of agencies, we've done some comparative analysis, which we updated for the Victorian review on the resourcing of integrity agencies. And there's a couple of tables here that just mention, that effectively show some of the change that's happened in the landscape of who's got what core integrity agencies. I won't go through that, but it's just when you're looking at the resourcing slides, these slides explain which agencies' resources are actually being counted in what I'm about to show you. This graph shows the combined staffing of what I'm calling here the core integrity agencies of our state and federal jurisdictions over time from 1990 to 2009, and that's staffing as a proportion of total staffing of that jurisdiction. Okay, so it's a percentage that remains relevant over time, and you can see here some interesting things. Victoria, recently changing its system a lot, is way down here at the bottom. It expanded its Ombudsman's Office and created an Office of Police Integrity in 2004 or thereabouts. A big injection of resources didn't actually change the overall picture a lot, and now it's talking about creating more resources, putting more resources in again with the new institutional configuration of its system, creating an anti-corruption commission. This line up here, the brown one with circles in it, is the Commonwealth line, and you can see how much it's gone up and down, but it's right up the top at the moment. If you take the combined staffing of the ANAO, the Ombudsman's Office and ACLI, put it together as a proportion of total Commonwealth public servants, Commonwealth doesn't actually employ as many public servants as New South Wales or Victoria or Queensland, obviously, but if you do that, you come out with quite a healthy figure. What makes life more interesting? So anything that might be added through a new integrity regime is sort of icing on the cake from that point of view in terms of staff resourcing bodies, you know, people behind desks or out and about doing surveillance or whatever. But if we do the same analysis in terms of expenditure, so this is the total budget of those same core agencies as a proportion of the total budget of the total own purpose expenditure of that jurisdiction, then you get a very different figure. It's actually WA that comes out on top, with Queensland not far behind. But the others are all middling, and the Commonwealth is right down here, at the bottom line. Why is that? Because the Commonwealth spends the vast bulk of the country's money. So a lot of what goes out from the Commonwealth, the Commonwealth budget is enormous, a lot of it goes out in the form of money. And financial control systems are the ones that are used to control the integrity of those programs. If you think about Centrelink, or you think about family assistance, or you think about all sorts of grant programs, funding programs, they all rely on giving money to other people to do things which the Commonwealth doesn't then take direct responsibility for in the same way that other jurisdictions do. But that in itself creates a big issue for what the Commonwealth wants to do with its integrity architecture, and it's brought to a head by things like the Building Education Revolution Fund, the Home Insulation Program. If we're going to be continuing to move into a generation where the Commonwealth continues to fund all sorts of programs directly using its financial position, then this line is actually an indicator of how is it going to manage the integrity of those programs. So some of those issues, which are current, you know, political issues and have been in the last 6 months, about the way that the Commonwealth has gone about doing business, so not just party political issues, they do actually provoke some thought about what is it that the Commonwealth wants to be concerned about when it comes to promoting integrity, managing accountability, dealing with corruption in programs under its auspices, which could include state delivered programs and all sorts of things. It's a much more complex picture than you might assume if you're just thinking, well, we need an anti-corruption commission, we'll just copy one from the state for a range of reasons. So those are just a list of the issues, and I think I've probably used up more than enough time. Although it's a complex field with lots of interesting issues to deal with, I remain optimistic that that this is a unique time in history. So working through these issues can only lead to a better system and stronger integrity and accountability, and I, for one, relish the fact that we've now got such a rich marketplace of political ideas on all of these issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, AJ. We've got 10 minutes or so, I think, for questions. Have any of the people in the audience wish to put any questions to Professor Brown? Yes.
Yep, that's the question that just comes, because at the moment I'm looking at executive versus parliamentary relationship there. And so the question about, essentially the regulation of politicians through a parliamentary integrity commissioner, I am curious, and I think you touched on it, but if you could elaborate a little bit more on the need for parliamentary sovereignty, I mean, the historical reasons for that, and how, I mean, I know these aren't executive organisations that are being created to police them, but if you could elaborate on maybe is there a conflict between parliamentary sovereignty with this extra regulation that you're proposing for politicians?
I mean, personally, I do. I think that there is. And it's not just because I'm a lawyer like Senator Brandis. Personally, I think that that the separation of powers is a constitutional doctrine that we've sort of grown familiar with, we take for granted, and we forget what it actually means. And we forget how vital it is to the health and integrity of the system overall. So I'm a bit of a black letter lawyer when it comes to the separation of powers and its value. The separation of powers between the parliament and the executive has always been obviously more blurred than the judiciary. I think that there's both those reasons of principle for saying that executive agencies. We've got to be careful about how executive agencies have a role in oversighting the work of the people's representatives. For the traditional reasons that civil wars were fought, I'm sure George's and other people's history here would be much better than mine in terms of British constitutional history and how we got to the system that we have. I come back to the fact we don't want to create a situation where any agencies that are under control of executive government, as opposed to under the effective control of the parliament itself, are in a position to compromise the work that the people's representatives do. But I suppose my other instinct, from a practical point of view, is that the nature of the work that the people's representatives do, the nature of the interests that they've got to manage and wheel and deal with as part of their political job, is just fundamentally different to the Weberian model of the professional public servant, under which the whole sort of integrity rubric of the executive works. Because politicians cannot separate all of their interests in the same way that day-to-day public servants must. I'm very unforgiving on public servants who can't figure out that that their cousin down the road is not the person who should get the contract to do whatever. But for a parliamentary representative, especially in the House of Reps, it's much more difficult. Everything has an electoral impact, and therefore it's you know, the cousin down the road has an electoral impact as well as everybody else. So it's a different relationship. And the second practical reason for why it's worth carrying the constitutional principle through to a different institutional result, I think, is that the experience in both Queensland and especially New South Wales, to some extent Western Australia, of having politicians the subject of the anti-corruption body is to derail an enormous amount of the resources and the time and the political angst of the people trying to run the Anti-Corruption Commission in dealing with politics that they shouldn't be dealing with, including defending themselves, including maintaining their own jurisdiction and protecting their own budget, because there's always politicians who would love to knife them. And it doesn't need to be that way. So I think that from a practical point of view, and there's plenty of people around the integrity agencies who will say this, from a practical point of view, it would be very much simpler if those agencies could just focus on the executive and public programs and service delivery and integrity and corruption issues in all of that, and there was some other mechanism that they could have a relationship for dealing with integrity and effectively integrity at a parliamentary level, and that it would just it would enhance the ability of those agencies to do their core business much more effectively and make them much less prone to political sniping and destabilisation and all sorts of issues. So I think all of those things sort of all point in one direction myself, but I'm not sure that everybody in Victoria who's debating this has thought through all of those issues. But the government appears to know what it's doing.
Other questions? Yes, the gentleman
from Victoria. I think the issue that's troubling people about the proposed model in Victoria is whether the idea of having the Integrity Commissioner advising and investigating is a wise or practical solution. For myself, I have a concern that people might be reluctant to go to the investigator to get advice, and the investigator also needs to be seen to be independent. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a much more important issue. I think that's a much more valid issue than the question of whether there is one or whether politicians should be under the General Anti-Corruption Commission. I think that's a much more serious issue. I come at that issue by thinking about the other integrity and regulatory agencies that I know that fulfil both functions at once, and the way in which they've, not always easily, but that they do get around to doing it. And I'm not just thinking about here of ombudsman's offices and other anti-corruption bodies, which do both of those things. They do an advising function, but things like the tax office, which the tax office both issues private binding rulings to people that says, not only will we give you advice on this, but we'll give you a legally binding guarantee that you can't be prosecuted for following this advice. That's the advisory role of the Parliamentary Integrity Commissioner. The same time, the tax office investigates, prosecutes to the full extent of the law. Now, it's not necessarily easy for those two roles to be to sit together. But the reality is, the other consideration that plays in my mind, again from practical experience, is that people take advice much more seriously if it comes from somebody who is going to jump on them if they do the wrong thing. That's sort of my overall experience of life, really. But that certainly applies in public integrity issues. That if you're going to get advice, you want to know that it's coming from somebody who really matters, who's got teeth at the end of the day, and not just getting some gratuitous advice. So I don't think that what I've just said necessarily answers all of the issues and resolves them all, and it's a very important debate to be had. But I think that provided that it's thought through well, I can't see why it shouldn't work, why it shouldn't be made to work. It's been a bit of a toothless tiger in Queensland, just having an integrity commissioner who could advise, and then you just sort of presume that everything's healthy, and then there's also been the Crime Misconduct Commission to clean things up if anything's gone wrong. But I think that we've got to look at some mechanisms for enabling the two functions to work together, and that's the way to look. That if we can make that work, then we should be looking for solutions there. That they should be obtainable. But I don't disagree with any suggestion that they are very, very important issues to get right. And if they couldn't be got right, then you'd need some institutional separation of them.
Other questions?
Yes. Thanks, AJ. I just wanted to see if you'd like to make a comment about the role of whistleblowing laws in relation to other initiatives in the government, such as the recent Law Reform Commission review of secrecy laws and the Declaration of Open Government and Web 2.0 processes and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, that's a big canvas. I guess your question simply emphasises my main point about these things all being interconnected, and the importance of finding a process that will actually let them be sorted through properly, but also a timely process. I mean, that's the challenge for the Parliament, is how to make these things align and gel. The good thing is that I think that the ALRC, when it did its review of the secrecy laws, was conscious that of what it was dealing with relative to what was being dealt with in thinking about public interest disclosure legislation. The ALRC has basically said, well, there needs to be a general defence, a public interest defence, if you like, to being prosecuted for the release of official information. But in fact, what they recommended is that the whole offence needs to be recast so that in effect the defence is built into the offence, so that you don't get prosecuted for stupid things. But at the same time, that they said that that there still needs to be the need for comprehensive public interest disclosure legislation, that because you're talking about all sorts of actions that aren't going to just be dealt with. The criminal offence of releasing official information is only one thing that can befall whistleblowers. So I think in the recommendations that are already there, I think that connection is already made. I guess in terms of the broader landscape of information generally, we live in interesting times. I'm doing another research project at the moment that involves looking at what's happening with WikiLeaks and trying to keep your head around the changing landscape of what is publication and what isn't publication for the purposes of these sorts of things is a big challenge for all of us. So. And it comes back to things like the definition of journalist in any of this legislation, whether it's the Shield Laws or public interest disclosure or whatever. Who is a journalist? Is Julian Assange a journalist? Well, he actually says he isn't a journalist and that he professes to be totally, a total alternative to journalism. But on the other hand, they obviously do publish. So there are some technicalities that are worth thinking about in terms of making sure that we don't do something which doesn't need amendment next year or the year after to cover the changing landscape. But I think some of those things are things that, we only know as the technology and the nature of information changes. That's the difficult job of Senator Brandis and others here to keep on trying to keep the legislation fulfilling its objectives as other things change, and I think some of those things will just change. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, I think we've run the course of our hour, so thank you very much indeed, AJ. That was very stimulating and illuminating to all of us, I'm sure. So please join me in thanking Professor Brown for being with us today.
Thank you. Let me make a demonstration.
Underestimate the seems to me the Speaker of Common Parliament is better track record than the technician. There is hardly any serious lack of integrity among the members and senators in the and yet it is an intensely morally hazardous environment. every day. And, you know, I mean it's kind of almost premised on a moral hazard that you're trustees of the public interest, but the process assumes you act self-interested. So it seems to me that the advisory function about the resolution of morally hazardous issues is something that would have a lot more work to do than an investigative function where there isn't a problem.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to allow how we can see ourselves as having been the complaint resolution function.
Nice to see you again, Andrew. You've got to rush off to the next thing.
Thank you so much for coming.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much for coming.
It just struck me as when you were putting up that data and the